Have any kids in the area? No. Vale quickened her pace, running toward and then up the stairs. Underwood followed. Where are you going?
I know where she's headed. She's going after my son.
How would she know how to find him?
Because I told her.
Vale ran out the front door and down the steps, not even thinking about slipping on the ice, not thinking about anything other than getting to Jonathan. She sprinted to her car, suddenly realizing Underwood was right behind her as she fumbled for the remote, attempting to unlock the door. He took it and hit the correct button. She grabbed the key fob back and got in. Underwood jumped into the Honda's passenger seat as she turned the engine over.
"I'll kill her, Thomas," she said as she accelerated hard away from the curb. "I'll kill her."
"Your son's gonna be fine." Vale was comforted slightly by his words, but she knew they were just that, words, without any power behind them. Well, perhaps faith. Is that enough? Vale pulled out her cell and handed it to Underwood.
"Call Jonathan. Look in the call log."
Underwood made the call, then swiveled it away from his mouth. "Voicemail." He pulled it back to his lips.
"Jonathan, call your mother immediately. Very important."
Vale clenched her jaw and shook her head.
"She hurts him. I'll hunt her down anywhere in the world if it's the last thing I do."
Thoughts of Uzi and DeSantos and their OPSIG Black Ops buddies flashed through her mind.
"Would they do that for me?"
"Karen," Underwood said firmly, "he's going to be okay.
He'll be okay if I make it okay. He's a young man in college. He doesn't know the darkness of evil. He's not prepared for that kind of malevolence."
"He grew up with a mother who's a cop, who's a profiler. Give him more credit than that."
"I've done my best to shield him from that stuff."
"He watches TV. He plays video games. He's got an idea."
"And he had an abusive father. Thomas is right. He's been exposed to more than I'd like to admit."
As Vale screeched around a corner, she thought about that. Again, she asked herself, was that enough?
Against a prolific, unfeeling serial killer? An attractive, intelligent, manipulative female serial killer who had no problems getting close to her male and female victims? "Call Robbie, my fiancé. He's DEA. He's in town."
He handed the Samsung back to her. As she read off the number, Underwood began tapping the digits into his iPhone, then nearly dropped the handset as she swerved around a curve. He pushed his right hand against the dashboard to steady himself.
"If we get killed in a car accident, we're not going to be able to help Jonathan."
"Let me worry about that." "Is this Robbie? This is a colleague of Karen's, Thomas Underwood."
"Put it on speaker," Vale said.
Underwood pressed the button and held up the cell.
"Robbie, I think Jasmine's taken Jonathan."
"Taken? Why would she do that?"
"Because I fucked up, and because Jasmine's the bloodline's killer."
There was silence.
"I need you to head toward GW. I don't know where Jonathan's class is. Can you look it up? He's not answering his phone."
"I'm on it. I'll text it to you and head over there. I'm on my way, but I'm out by Silver Hill. Just hold it together, Karen. We'll find him."
More hollow assurances. Vale's phone vibrated. "Gotta go. Let me know what you find out."
She looked at her Samsung and tried to read the text. "How about I drive?" Underwood said, his gaze fixed on the streets ahead of them.
"Under the seat, I've got an auxiliary light."
He scooted forward against the shoulder restraint, reached for and found the device. He rolled down the window and a blast of cold air wrapped around Vale's exposed neck. She heard the magnetic clunk as it attached to the roof. "Done. Now, please, drive carefully."
"Curtis has the app and he's got a location," she said, dropping the cell onto the seat between her thighs.
"Whole task force is en route."
"No, too easy."
She grabbed up the Samsung again, called Uzi.
"Karen, got your text. Sent the link to Kurt.
I need you to help me find Jonathan. He's not answering his phone, and I think he's in danger."
"What kind of phone does he use?"
Vale accelerated around a Hyundai waiting to make a turn.
"iPhone."
"You can track him using the Find My iPhone app, but you'll need his Apple ID, and it's not pinpoint accurate."
"Don't have his ID. What about Stingray? The Bureau's got that equipment, right?"
"Even better," Uzi said. "You're working with the Marshal Service. They've got mobile Stingrays, vans outfitted with the devices that can..."
"Got it. Call you back if I hit a roadblock."
She hit end and struggled to bring up Hurdle's number on her handset. He answered on the third ring. "Kind of busy," he said. "I'm on my..."
"You got a mobile stingray deployed in the area? Anywhere near Foggy Bottom?"
"We do. Why, you think Jasmine Marks is using her phone?"
"My son, I think Jasmine's taken him, or she's gonna take him."
"Give me his number. I'll try to get a location." After Vail read it off to Hurdle, she swerved around a slow-moving pickup and nearly sideswiped a parked car. "What stingray?" Underwood asked, gripping the door handle with white-knuckled intensity.
"A mobile device that mimics a cell phone tower. It sends out a stronger signal than nearby towers to force a specific phone to connect to it instead of the real tower. It then triangulates the signal strength of that cell signal and uses software to give you a location. It can do a lot more than that, but if it can find Jonathan..."
"That's all we need," Underwood said.
"No, that's not all we need. We'll be blocks from the White House in a matter of minutes. Law enforcement all over the place. Let's call in the troops."
"And say what? I think a prolific serial killer's on the loose somewhere in Foggy Bottom, but I'm running on pure speculation without an ounce of proof. Once they hear she may have your son, they're going to write you off as a hysterical mother trying desperately to save her boy." Vail looked at him. "Keep your eyes on the road and tell me I'm wrong."
"Fine. Right now, I'm a hysterical mother trying desperately to save her son. But I don't know what else to do, and I do know Jasmine, and I'm pretty damn sure she's going after Jonathan."
"I think you're right. But we need some proof before we pull that fire alarm."
"Because if I'm wrong, they'll never give me any credibility. Right now, I couldn't give a shit about tomorrow or the day after. All I care about is tonight, making sure my son's safe."
"No, Karen. Problem is that they won't deploy. And if we do get some proof, they'll have already said no. It'll be harder to convince them. You'd be the woman who cried wolf."
"Fine. We'll give it 5 minutes. At most. Meantime, call campus police. Alert them to a potential problem."
As Underwood looked up the number, Vail tightened her grip on the wheel.
"Potential problem may be an understatement."
Chapter 60. Jasmine stood inside the large packed campus Starbucks cafe, a hot cappuccino in her left hand, and her face seemingly fixated on her phone. But in reality, she was watching the Phillips Hall exit for Jonathan Vail. With the information Vail had given her, combined with some internet sleuthing, a phone call, and a couple of assumptions, she was able to ascertain that Jonathan was likely in one of five classes. Upon further narrowing the parameters, following a conversation with a helpful junior, she figured he would be coming out of his criminology class at 6:03 p.m. At 6:02, with snow flurries falling and the temperature dropping into the 20s, Jasmine left the warmth of Starbucks and started walking slowly toward the building. It was possible she had miscalculated. Her crack detective work notwithstanding, she had to admit she did not have a lot of time to think it through. But she would deal with a failed attempt by withdrawing and living to fight another day. There were other ways to take care of business, and as long as she was smart about it, she would have enough time to get to both her father and Vail, even if it meant a direct assault rather than taking out Jonathan, someone who meant more to Vail than anything else. There were, of course, advantages to offing Jonathan. Vail would be forced to live with the pain of having her son murdered by a killer she failed to recognize, despite years of interaction. It would be an ongoing nightmare. As she approached the recessed glass doors, now only about 50 feet away, Jonathan emerged, phone pressed against his ear. She quickened her pace, closing the distance, ready to begin her spiel.
"Yeah," Jonathan said into the handset. "Just got out of class. Taking Uber. Be there in 10.
He started to cross H Street, where a white Toyota Camry had stopped in front of a line of cars. Jasmine slowed. Change of plans. Jonathan said something to the driver through the partially cracked window, then pulled open the rear door and got in. As he started to swing it closed, Jasmine grabbed it and stuck her head in.
"Mind if I share?"
"This is Uber," Jonathan said. "I've already paid."
"Not a problem." Jasmine dug into her purse and pulled out a 20. "On me. I've got to meet my girlfriend, and it's so cold."
She gave him an award-winning shiver and sad face.
I'm going into Georgetown. Friends are wait. So am I. Please, she said, drawing it out, again holding up the 20. A horn honked behind them. The driver, a slight middle-aged black man, swiveled in his seat and looked at Jonathan. We need to get going. Jonathan took the money and slid over. Jasmine pulled the door closed as the driver accelerated.
Where in Georgetown are you going?
She could feel Jonathan's eyes on her as she sorted herself out, reaching into her purse and glancing up at him, then stopping to make eye contact. She could tell he was just now noticing her beauty.
Bowie Mongers on Prospect.
So, what are you studying at GW?
She giggled.
I saw you come out of Phillips.
Jonathan glanced at the building out the rear window as it receded into the distance.
You know G.W.?
Alum. Criminal justice major.
Me too.
Really?
Did you have white, sir?
For criminology, of course.
The driver turned left onto 20th Street, which was clear. He sped up and hung a left onto Pennsylvania. She adjusted her left hand inside her purse and held out her right.
I'm Jessica.
He took it and shook.
I'm Jonna.
But he did not get the word out, because she yanked him close and slapped a soaked rag up against his mouth and nose. He tried to pull back, but she had done this too many times. She knew the way a person resisted, and she was ready. His fight lessened as he drifted into an unconscious state.
Hey, the driver shouted, the fuck's going on back there?
He passed out, Jasmine said. I've got him. It's okay.
She removed the garrote from her purse and whipped it over the driver's head and pulled it tight. Both hands left the steering wheel as he tried, as they all do, to pry the wire off his neck. It never worked. Jasmine leaned forward, using leverage and her 135 pounds of weight to cut off the blood supply from the man's brain. The Toyota drifted right, sideswiped a car, and wedged itself behind another vehicle. The driver's body went limp, and she quickly gathered up the garrote and shoved it back into her purse. Jasmine grabbed his jacket and yanked him to the right, toward the passenger seat. She had never done this before, and although he was thin and relatively short, he probably weighed 150 pounds. While she was accustomed to lifting weights in the gym, the confined space made this a much more difficult task. She could not use her powerful leg muscles very efficiently. It was harder to move him than she thought. Jasmine did not have much time. Mere seconds had passed, but the Camry was partially blocking the right lane, and people had undoubtedly seen the accident, though it was unlikely anyone saw what transpired inside the dark interior. She gave a quick glance around. It was a three-lane road in each direction, and they were next to a small community park on the right side, so there were not many people in the area on a cold and snowy night, and cars were flowing around the Toyota, rushing to wherever they were going. Sometimes the apathy of time-stressed Americans was useful. Jasmine got his torso draped over the center armrest, leaving enough room for her to fit behind the wheel. She turned off the dome light and opened the back door, careful to avoid the passing vehicles in the adjacent lane. Jasmine forced her bottom onto the front seat, then grabbed the man's jeans and pushed and lifted and groaned, then reached over and pulled his shirt forward, directing his head toward the floor. That helped, and she was able to get his ass onto the console. She bent his knees and wedged them up near his chest. Seconds later, her upper body drenched in perspiration from the Herculean effort, she directed the Camry down Pennsylvania Avenue. She would use Washington Circle only a few blocks down to turn around and head back to Arlington. She had not made it very far when she heard a noise. A cell phone vibrating. Stopped at a light, she leaned closer to the driver's body, but it was coming from the back seat. Jonathan. As soon as she got the green, she made her way over to the right and parked in front of a bus stop. She got into the rear of the vehicle and dosed Jonathan once again to buy more time, then patted him down and found his phone. There was a text from someone named Patrick. In the back, got a table. And a missed call from Vale. Jasmine craned her neck toward the windshield, but did not see anyone taking an interest in the car. She returned to the task at hand and listened to Vale's message. She knew that voice.
Impossible. I killed him.
No longer concerned about passers-by, Jasmine pulled out her own phone and opened the secure home app for her surveillance cameras. She squeezed the handset while waiting for it to make the connection. Seconds later, she saw the basement of her house and Thomas Underwood's body, which she had left on the floor in the middle of the hidden room, was not there.
I can't go back there. They know.
Jasmine picked up Jonathan's phone, returned to the driver's seat, and pulled away. No need to use Washington Circle now. She had to find another place for her kill. As she mulled that thought, she tore Jonathan's iPhone from its case and tossed the device out the window. It struck the snowy asphalt and bounced a split second before a car tire crushed it. And that's when she figured out where she should go. Chapter 61. Vale's phone buzzed and Underwood answered. He listened a moment, then put it on speaker. It's Eric Curtis. That tracking device of yours is working.
Thank God. Curtis, what have you got?
Jasmine's in motion, but so far we've got a clean signal.
Am I right? GW?
GW's huge, but yeah, looks like the outskirts. On our way, not that far.
Can you text the location to us? I'm driving and Thomas has never used Uzi's app.
Will do, and I'll let you know as soon as we get there. The second Underwood hung up, her phone vibrated.
That was fast.
Underwood shook his head. It's not Curtis. It's a message from your boss, Lewis Hurdle. They're locked onto Jonathan's phone, Stingray.
Vale straightened up in her seat. Now we're in business. Her Samsung dinged again. Curtis's text?
Yeah, Underwood said. He sent us the location.
Tell me where I'm going.
His head jerked up from the screen. They're different.
What do you mean?
The tracker is not in the same place as Jonathan.
Call him. Call Jonathan. If he's moving, he's no longer in class. He should hear his phone.
Assuming he turned the volume up after class ended.
And assuming Jasmine doesn't have him.
I still need to call campus PD. Gonna do that first. Get them on board. We could use their eyes and ears on the ground. They know their streets and buildings better than us. Then we can figure out what's going on. Hurdle's headed towards the Stingray location, and Curtis is going after that tracking device you've got on Jasmine. We're covered. Hang tight.
Hang tight? Is he serious? Hang tight?
Underwood went through some verbal sparring with campus police, but ultimately convinced them they could have a serial killer on site and that a target could be a student, Jonathan Vale, who was leaving one of his classes.
Which one? Which building? Underwood asked Vale. No idea. I asked him for his schedule, but I don't think he gave it to me. I just know he's done with classes today at 6.
Underwood related that information and told them he had two potential locations.
Yes. This is a federal agent's son, Vale, Karen Vale, FBI.
He listened a moment, thanked them, then hung up.
So?
So, I was right. They don't know what to make of it. You have a photo of Jonathan and Jasmine?
Nothing of Jasmine, but I took a good one of Jonathan a couple weeks ago with my fiancé.
She gestured at the phone. In gallery.
Underwood navigated the screen, tapping and swiping.
Got it. Sending it through to them now.
There's probably one of Jasmine on her website. Have them Google it. No idea what it is.
They're getting a couple of cars out to circulate in the area and alerting foot patrols. But other than looking for Jonathan, which is why I wanted the picture, they didn't seem to have a plan of action. Can't say I blame them.
Open up that app. Let's see if I can talk you through how to use it.
Underwood had the program up and running as Vale turned right onto 23rd Street Northwest, now blocks from GW. As she began her explanation, Hurdle called through. Vale reached over and put it on the Bluetooth speaker.
We got a problem, Hurdle said. I don't want to hear about problems.
Hurdle ignored the comment and continued. Stingray had a fix on Jonathan's phone along Pennsylvania Avenue and then it winked out.
Winked out? What the hell does that mean?
It means the signal disappeared. They said it can be caused by the phone powering down, but Stingray can do all kinds of shit, including tracking the phone even if it's off.
And?
And they're not getting anything, which means the phone's probably broken.
Vale felt a knot in her intestines. As in, smashed.
Yeah, something violent,
like hitting it with a hammer or throwing it from a moving vehicle. Phil took a deep breath, trying to keep herself calm. Where on Pennsylvania Avenue was the last known position?
Near 22nd, but we're here right now and there's nothing. No sign of Jonathan or the phone. But there's all kinds of shit in the road, snow and slush and salt. Not sure we'd find it unless we plowed it and went through the crap by hand.
Damn it. Jonathan would not do this. She has him. Can we all agree that Jasmine's got him?
Hurdle hesitated a second, then, yeah, that'd be my assumption.
That tracking device I planted on her, it started working again. Curtis has it up and running.
I'll get the location from them. Keep me posted, I'll do the same.
Vale continued driving, unsure of where she was going or even what they would do when they got there.
Where would she take him? Underwood asked.
Depends on why she wants him. Could be to lure me to her.
If she wanted you, she'd call you.
Then why else?
To kill him. I'm sorry, Karen, but now's the time for independent rational thought. You have to somehow divorce your emotions. Think logically, clearly. Can you do that?
I'm his mother. How can I do that?
I asked you a question, Underwood said firmly. Can I count on you to think clearly?
Yes! Yes!
Vale took a deep breath and slowed the vehicle. She had unknowingly brought it up to 40 in a 25 zone with college students milling about on the sidewalks.
If she wants to kill this victim, she'd take him back to her house in Arlington where she killed her other victims.
Except that we have to assume that by now she's looked in on Rusty.
Vale nodded, and she'll see that he's no longer there. And in his place is a bunch of crime scene personnel.
Vale pulled to a spot by the curb.
So she'd think we probably found her Arlington house, too, and you, right?
Underwood blew some air through his lips. I don't know. It's possible. She also has a camera there. It's likely. Why not? That's probably how she knew I wasn't trying to escape. She must have looked in on me from time to time.
Wait. There were two victims, the Bloodline's killer, Jasmine, murdered on site. Deviations from her other kills.
Yeah, Underwood nodded slowly, staring straight out the windshield. Carla Racanelli and Nancy Ermine.
Ermine was killed in Fredericksburg, Prince William Forest, the national park.
Yeah, that's how we got federal jurisdiction to prosecute Marks.
Fredericksburg is too far away. She offed Racanelli somewhere in Georgetown, right?
Yes, Vale thought about that.
None of what's going down right now was planned. Maybe Jonathan wasn't part of what she wanted to do. She feels cornered. She now knows that we know she's the Bloodline's killer. She's desperate, thinking on the fly. Not much to lose. And now she wants to get back at the person who ruined her life, who figured out she was the killer. Me. And that's why she took Jonathan.
She swung her gaze over to Underwood.
And if that's the case, she needs a place to...
Her voice caught.
A place to kill her victim. Focus, Karen. Get past this. Be objective.
I agree.
She'll go back to where she killed Racanelli. A place she knows will give her decent cover. A place nearby. Do you remember exactly where her body was found?
Kind of. The general area. Head toward Georgetown. We'll figure it out.
Vale pulled away from the curb and accelerated.
Chapter 62. The auxiliary light was still flashing, so Vale leaned on the horn and cars cleared away for them.
We need to get the exact location, she said. Don't have time to guess wrong. Call Gifford. I've got his cell.
A moment later, it was ringing through the Bluetooth. Voicemail came on and Vale left a message.
Try my unit chief. Looking contacts. Stacy DiCarlo.
I've got it. Underwood manipulated the phone, and it again began ringing. You think she's still at the office this late?
No idea. Don't know much about her, except that I don't like her.
DiCarlo!
Vale shot a look at Underwood. Maybe I need to reevaluate her. This is Karen Vale. I need some help. Can you look something up in my files?
Your files? For what?
I don't have time to explain, but it's got to do with the Bloodline's case. Thomas Underwood's in the car with me. The killer's not who we thought it was, and she's got my son. Whoa, back up a second, Vale. What the hell are you going on about?
Look, I don't mean any disrespect, but I don't have time for this. Just pull up my files. If you can't do that, I'll find someone else to help.
We'll deal with your insubordination later. Tell me what you need.
I need a new unit, Chief. Exact location where the Racanelli body was found. Carla Racanelli.
Where am I looking?
I organized the file by victim, Underwood said. Everything's cross-referenced, but fastest way to get what we need is to go to the Racanelli tab. He turned to Vale. Did you change the file?
Just added to it. All your original reports and notes are just as you left them.
I'm calling it up on the server, DiCarlo said. Give me a few minutes to sort through everything.
If it was your son, you wouldn't need a few minutes.
Text me the location as soon as you've got it. I need to make another call.
Underwood hit the red end call icon and looked to Vale for instructions.
Call Curtis.
He was on the line seconds later. Good timing, Karen. We're closing in on the tracking signals 20.
Chapter 63. Curtis pulled to a stop in front of the Gibson at 23rd and L, a 10-story brick apartment building. Tarkov got out, his Glock in hand, moving forward cautiously. Curtis followed, consulting the iPhone's display as he walked up to a large chain-link fence.
Well?
He could barely hear Vale's voice emanating from the speaker, but did not want to take his eyes off the screen until they got a fix on Jasmine.
Used to be a Metro PD building here, but now it's a huge construction site, he said, keeping his voice low. Give us a minute.
They stood shoulder to shoulder, Tarkov looking out at the street while Curtis peered through the narrow openings between the privacy slats at the steel girders that represented the structure's skeleton.
Ben, you see anything?
Tarkov looked down the block, turned in a 360-degree arc, and faced Curtis.
Nope. He again checked the map on the iPhone. She should be right here, 30 feet away, maybe around the corner. I can't see because of all that heavy equipment behind the fence.
They walked about 15 paces when Curtis stopped and elbowed Tarkov.
That woman in the parka crossing L.
She's got a hood up, can't see her face, but there's no one else nearby.
Let's check it out.
Tarkov dodged an approaching taxi and jogged across 23rd, approaching from the left as Curtis came up behind her.
Police! Curtis yelled. Don't move! Get down on the ground!
Chapter 64. Vale turned to Underwood, her eyes wide, her pulse racing. She kept driving, leaning forward in her seat, listening for any clues as to what was happening.
Is it her?
Tarkov's voice.
No, Curtis said. God damn it, son of a bitch.
Into the handset.
Not her, Karen. She's got the tracking device in her jacket pocket, but it's not Jasmine.
She beat me at my own game.
Karen, you hear me?
Yeah, I got it. Thomas and I are on our way to a place that may have meaning to her, where she killed before, Racanelli.
Racanelli, that was somewhere in the outskirts of Georgetown. A park?
We're trying to get an address. Soon as we have it, I'll send it to you.
Underwood disconnected the call, but Vale's phone rang almost immediately. He held up the Samsung.
Someone named Oliver Aldrich?
Vale whipped her head toward him so hard it popped.
What?
He showed her the screen. Oliver Aldrich.
Aldrich was killed by...
She stopped.
Answer it.
A familiar voice came through the speakers. Smooth, cold, unemotional.
Hello, Karen.
Chapter 65. Marks, he chuckled.
You don't sound happy to hear from me.
I've got more important matters to deal with, and unless you can give me your daughter's whereabouts, you're wasting my time.
My daughter? His voice got deeper. I'm going to kill her. Then I'm going to kill you.
Good luck trying to find her. I'm looking for her, too,
he snorted. I know exactly where she is.
Vale turned slowly to face Underwood.
You do?
She's in the car, right in front of me. And I completely understand why you've got more important matters to deal with.
Looks like she's got your son.
Where are you?
She leaned closer to the speaker. Marks, where are you? He hung up. Underwood said, I'm sorry. Vale cursed under her breath, then told him to call Hurdle.
Got something for me? Hurdle asked.
Yeah, she said. A new number. Get Stingray on it. Underwood read it off to him. Belongs to a phone Marks is using, but do not engage him. He's following Jasmine. If we play this right, we'll get them both.
Hope you're right. Hurdle out.
Makes two of us. Vale pointed at the Samsung. Get back to DiCarlo. See if she's got that 20. Underwood made the call, but kept it off Bluetooth.
No, this is Tom Underwood. Agent Vale's driving. You have a location?
He listened a moment.
Yeah, that's the one.
He waited, exchanged a glance with Vale, then slapped his thigh.
That's it, he said into the phone. Got it.
Another beat, then.
We're on our way. We're pretty close.
As he hung up, Vale said, text it to Curtis, Robbie, and Hurdle. She sat up in her seat and accelerated.
Keep it under control, Underwood said calmly as he tried to tap out the message. His finger kept flying off the keyboard with each bump and jerk of the car. We need to get there in one piece.
I'm going to kill that bitch, Thomas.
I understand, he said as he hit send, and I'd feel the same way, but
unless someone gets there before me,
someone named Roscoe Lee Marks.
You're not listening, Karen, he said with the even firmness of a father imparting wisdom to his daughter.
Let justice take its course. Jasmine needs to stand trial and be properly convicted of the murders we'd wrongly pinned on Marks.
With what evidence? Do you have her admission on tape? 'Cause I sure don't. And unless I'm missing something, I don't see much of a case. You want justice, it's gonna have to come some other way.
Can't say I like the sound of this.
You'll like it even less when she walks out of the courtroom with a case dismissed smile plastered all over her face.
Promise me you'll show restraint. Let the system do its job. I have faith.
She gave him a quick glance. This isn't one of your TV shows, Thomas. Not every case ends happily ever after. Did you forget what it's like out there?
No. Did you?
Touché. Vale took a breath. Shit. I've been spending too much time with black operators where there are no rules other than accomplishing the mission. But this isn't that.
You're right. I'm sorry. I'm just very upset.
Underwood seemed to accept that because he did not reply.
But Thomas, I'm telling you now. If she hurts my son, everything goes out the window.
Including your career?
Vale did not hesitate. Including my career.
Chapter 66. The vibration of her phone made her heart skip a beat.
Who is it?
Lewis Hurdle. On speaker. Underwood pressed a button and the wind noise of an SUV filled the Honda's passenger compartment.
Please, tell me you've got a location on Marks.
We do, Hurdle said. He's on the move, so I'm going to patch us through to the Stingray team. Hang on while I make the connection.
Seconds later, Vale heard more voices on the line.
I think we've got Deputy Henderson, correct?
10-4.
Henderson said, Agent Vale, I've got that phone number and I'm sending the location beacon directly to your handset.
You can do that?
Yes, ma'am. And here's another thing we can do. I tapped into Mark's cell and I'm using it as a microphone, but doesn't sound like there's anyone else in the car with him because no one's talking.
Underwood held up Vale's Samsung.
Got it. I see the beacon on the map.
Vale glanced over at the screen, but could not keep her eyes off the road long enough to make anything out.
Is it near the location where she killed Carla Racanelli? Vale asked.
Looks like it, Underwood said. He's headed right for it.
We're minutes out, Hurdle said. Curtis and Tarkoff are meeting the rest of us en route, so sounds like you'll get there first.
Understood, Vale tightened her grip on the wheel. Problem is, Marks is going to get there before me.
Chapter 67.
Jasmine was concentrating on the dark streets, looking for one particular location. Every minute or so, she glanced back at Jonathan, who, she figured, would be waking up very shortly. She had been thinking of how she needed to approach the coming hours. If Vale had discovered Underwood's body in the basement, they would have left him there until the medical examiner arrived, and that meant her first impression, bolstered by the message she heard on Jonathan's phone, was correct. Underwood had somehow survived, and that altered the dynamic of all that would need to come. It was a fatal error, one of the few she had ever made, perhaps the only one. Everything had been so well calculated, so well planned. Her execution was almost always near flawless, and even when it was not, it still worked. Her father landed in prison, but she was free to continue killing. True, she had to modify her methods, using crime concealment fires to hide her handiwork, but even that had gone well. She enjoyed the fires more than she thought when she came across the idea in Underwood's book. And then her father had called, letting her know he had escaped and was coming for her. He thought it would scare her, intimidate her, but it was exactly what she had been planning all along. While she had not yet disposed of him, she figured she had plenty of time to do so because he would forever be looking for her. He was like that, to a fault, fixated, unable to let go of a grudge. And this was more than a mere grudge. This was more than personal. She knew that. She constructed it that way. She would either kill him or a cop would kill him. She doubted he would allow himself to go back to prison. Now, however, the entire equation had changed. Time was no longer hers to manipulate. She might not be able to get to him before the cops did, because with all the publicity surrounding her father's escape and now the revelation that she was the Bloodline's killer, she had to believe that law enforcement would spare little to track her down. Sticking around increased the likelihood she would be captured. She had to take what she could, what was in reach, and right now that meant Jonathan. It would destroy Vale, she was sure of that. Like Superman's kryptonite, killing her son would sap her of her essence, emasculate her like nothing else could. The more she thought about it, this was the better call. Far better than killing Vale herself. As Jasmine approached the wooded neighborhood, Jonathan stirred. She wanted to dose him again because he would undoubtedly attempt to fight back, and it would be easier to get rid of him without all the drama. Jasmine now realized that this kill would not be as enjoyable as the others had been. It couldn't be. With Vale and Curtis and the task force now likely looking for her, she would have less time with the body. This pissed her off. But she knew the smarter thing would be to get it over with and get away. Another city, another state. Maybe Canada or Mexico. She didn't know how big the net would be, but she was sure they would make it difficult. She had a contingency plan in place with a neat little diversion, a pipe bomb, along with a phony tweet and Facebook post replete with a bombastic radical Islamic claim of responsibility. If she timed her escape right in the minutes and hours after the explosion, she might be able to make it work. A serial killer did not warrant the attention and resources a terror group did. She pulled down the tree-lined street and slowed opposite some densely wooded parkland. Flurries were still fluttering this way and that, making the icy ground even more slick. Jasmine found the spot she was looking for and brought the Toyota to a stop. Jonathan moaned as she shoved the gear shift into park. She dug into her purse to ready the ether and reached for the door handle. But the driver's side window shattered, showering her face with glass. What the f-? She felt two hands on her neck, looked up, and saw her father. She grabbed his forearms, knowing instinctively not to try to pry his fingers away from her skin. She heard him yelling something. "I'm gonna fucking kill you!" And for the first time in her life, she believed him. Dug her nails into his muscle-taut flesh. Had to be drawing blood, but he did not yield. She slid her arms down to his wrists with all her body weight. She yanked suddenly and forcefully to the right. Marx was not expecting it and lost his balance, striking his head on the doorframe. She leaned left and again pulled hard right and again slammed his face into the metal, the jagged remains of glass slicing his nose and eyes. One more blow to the head and his grip loosened and his hands left her neck and he dropped out of sight. Unconscious? But for how long? Jasmine turned around toward Jonathan, but the rear passenger door was swinging closed and the seat was empty. Chapter 68. Jasmine hoisted herself into the back of the Camry, with the Uber driver blocking the passenger's seat, and her father likely, hopefully, unconscious outside her front door. It was the fastest way out. She stepped into the freezing night air. 15 yards away, Jonathan was stumbling forward, slipping and sliding like a drunken sailor chasing a pretty woman down the street. Jasmine jogged after him, using a broad-based gait to maintain her balance. She knew that ahead of him was a tall fence that enclosed a children's play area. As he would soon see, he had nowhere to run. Even if he was fully lucid, which by now he might be, her prior victims were older individuals. A young man's metabolism could be different, so she had to assume the drug had cleared or was close to clearing his system. She caught up to him and tackled him from behind, took him face down onto the icy ground, but he twisted onto his back and kicked her in the nose, stunning her and driving her head back. She literally saw black and pinpricks of stars twinkling all around her. Her vision cleared and she got slowly to her feet, careful to keep her footing. But Jonathan was in full escape mode, and he was scrabbling forward on the slick frozen snow, moving his legs fast but not getting very far. He suddenly stopped and straightened up. He had undoubtedly seen the obstacle in his path because he turned to face her. Nowhere to run. Nowhere to hide. Jasmine pulled out an exceptionally lethal knife and smiled. Maybe this would be more enjoyable than she had thought. Chapter 69. "We're half a mile away," Underwood said. "Is Marx there yet?" His signal just stopped moving. Maybe. Bale accelerated and swerved on a patch of black ice, sideswiping a car. "Come on, Karen. Stay in control." "You need to slow down," Underwood said, his voice steady, even though his right hand was clutching the dashboard, while his left maintained a white-knuckled grip on the Samsung. "If Marx is there..." She did not finish the sentence, because she did not want to consider the implications. Two killers with my son. No matter how she parsed it, this was not a good situation. Vale's brights illuminated the landscape in front of her. "This is that park where she killed Racanelli." "Right up ahead," Underwood said, pointing into the snowy darkness. "A block away." Her lights hit what looked like a man lying still in the street beside a white sedan. "Big body," Underwood said. "Could be Marx." Vale was going too fast for a residential street in this weather. She tapped her brakes and skidded a bit. "Wait in the car, Thomas." "What?" "You're not a cop anymore. You don't even have a gun. And you don't have any backup." As they approached, Vale saw two cars, not just the white sedan. "You're retired. 15 years from now, you think you'd be waiting in the car while someone goes after the killer?" Off to the right were two figures. "That's Jonathan!" "And Jasmine." "Oh, my God!" Chapter 70. Jasmine advanced on Jonathan, a karambit knife fisted in her right hand, its anodized black blade all but hidden from his sight. "I'm not gonna hurt you," she said. "I'm trying to help you." Jonathan's breathing was rapid and shallow, spewing vapor into the dark, moist air. "Who are you?" "Your mom's friend." "Bullshit! You drugged me or something." "That was Jessica, the woman who got into the car before me." Jonathan's eyes were darting back and forth. She knew that look, had seen it in her prior victims. He was trying to fight through the cobwebs to reason it out.
Come with me. I'll take you to Robbie. He asked me to pick you up. That guy who escaped, Roscoe Lee Marks, is trying to kill you.
What are you talking about? Why would he...
To get back at your mother. She helped put him in prison.
I don't...
Didn't you see Marks back there by the car? He was trying to get to you. I fought him off.
She yanked down on her collar and showed him what surely looked like red marks encircling her neck.
He almost killed me. Now, come on. We don't have time to debate this. He's gonna wake up. He's very dangerous.
Jasmine sensed weakness. He was buying her story and letting his guard down. She held out her left hand and wiggled her fingers.
Come on, she said with a reassuring smile. Let's go. It's freezing.
Jonathan took a step toward her and then stopped.
No.
Headlights splashed across them as she lunged forward, arcing the karambit in a sweeping motion. Jonathan blocked it with his left forearm, then threw a quick right jab, catching Jasmine in the chin and driving her back. The knife dropped from her hand and Jonathan went for it, but so did Jasmine. Jonathan snatched the karambit off the ice a second before she could get there and buried the blade in her abdomen. Jasmine gasped and froze in place, hunched over. She stumbled a couple of steps, then fell to her knees. Chapter 71 Fail lurched, slipped, and slid toward her son, Glock in hand. She glanced at Jasmine on the ground and ran into Jonathan, embracing him so hard he had to pry her away to breathe.
Thank God! Thank God!
Is she dead?
Fail let go of Jonathan and knelt beside Jasmine. She holstered her Glock and felt for a pulse, then rolled Jasmine onto her back. A knife was buried deep in her stomach, only the handle protruding. Jasmine brought a hand up and made a weak attempt to pull it out. Fail placed her palm atop the karambit and kept it in place. Blood pulsed from the wound.
You're pathetic.
Jasmine whispered, struggling to keep her eyes open.
7 years. You were clueless.
Fail tightened her grip on the knife's handle. Took me a while, but in the end, we got it right. She looked into Jasmine's eyes.
Time to meet your maker, to pay for what you did.
Jasmine stared at her, and seconds later, her hand dropped from the knife. Vale stood up and handed Jonathan her cell.
Call an ambulance.
She hustled over to the Camry and bent over Marks to feel for a pulse. But two meaty hands grabbed her wrist, tight and unyielding. He got to his feet and swung Vale around as if she were a sack of apples and pulled her against his body. He put her in a headlock, both arms forced skyward. She could not move, could not reach her gun or the tanto. Vale squirmed and tried swinging her left forearm back, but he had a good hold on her, so good that she had only a limited range of motion with that limb. The right was completely immobilized. He pushed forward slightly, forcing her head farther down toward her chest.
Trying to snap my neck?
If I was trying, it'd be broken already. But make one wrong move and I'll do just that.
Yeah?
She said, struggling to breathe over the intense pain.
I got that.
He removed her Glock and tossed it to the ground behind him. He felt around and located the tanto, then slid it out of its sheath and brought it around the front of her neck, pressed it against her carotid.
Mom?
Jonathan had Jasmine's bloody knife in his hands, forearm taut, his body infused with anger.
Let go of her! He said between clenched teeth. Now!
Mark snorted.
You know who I am.
Let go of her!
I've got a better idea, Mark said. Put that knife down or I'll kill her.
No way do you put that knife down, Fail said. If he's going to kill me, he's going to kill me. He's not going to spare me because you drop your weapon. He's a killer, Jonathan.
Jonathan's eyes were wavering, looking at Marks, the knife, back to Marks, everywhere but his mother.
There's no way out of this for you, Vale said. You're going back to prison for all the people you killed.
William Reynolds, Nathan Anderson, Oliver, Marks squeezed harder, pushing her arm forward another inch.
He
He's gonna break my neck. I've had enough of you, Vale. You're gonna do what I tell you to do. First, you're going to admit you got it wrong in front of your son. Tell him you fucked up, that you made my life a living hell, helped put me in prison for murders I didn't commit. That was my doing, asshole, Underwood's voice. Vale did not know what was happening. She was forced to stare at the snow-covered ground, but she had a pretty good idea. Underwood had taken the Glock Marx had thrown aside and was holding it against the man's ear or temple or back. "You got a beef?" Underwood said. "It's with me. I'm the one who drew up that profile. Anyone's responsible? It's me. Now, drop the knife or I'll pull this trigger and feel damn good about it." "Jonathan," Vale said, "go wait in the car." "I'm not going anywhere," he said. "Make him drop that knife." "First, I want an apology," Mark said. "An apology?" Underwood grunted. "You know, you're right. I'm really sorry you killed your wife and a bunch of other innocent people because you're gonna get the death penalty. Now drop the fucking knife or I'll drive a 9mm round through your goddamn skull and save the taxpayers a few million dollars. You have till 3. 3. Marx loosened his grip on both Vale and the Tanto, which fell to the ground. Vale knocked his hands away and grabbed his wrists, pulled out her handcuffs and ratcheted them down hard. The headlights of two approaching SUVs bounced a few dozen yards away. The vehicles drove over the curb and into the park, stopping just in front of them. Hurdle got out of the lead vehicle, followed by Curtis and Walters, Morrison and Tarkoff. "Damn," Hurdle said, surveying the scene. "Looks like we missed all the fun." "Well, well, well," Curtis said, taking hold of Mark's cuffed forearm. "Look who caught the fugitive, Hurdle, the FBI. Hurdle holstered his sidearm. "Give me a break." "No, no, no," Vale said. "It was a team effort. In fact, why don't you guys both do the honors?" Curtis and Hurdle led Marx away toward the SUV as another car pulled up. Robbie jumped out, leaving his door open. He said something to Curtis before seeing Vale and Jonathan, then ran over to them. "Got here as soon as I could." As he gathered them in an embrace, he squinted into the darkness. "Is that Jasmine?" "Yeah." Robbie stepped back and looked at Vale. "How?" Vale told Robbie what happened, letting Jonathan fill in the details. Robbie held out his fist and Jonathan bumped it. "When I saw Jasmine go at him," Vale said, "my heart stopped. Come on, Mom. I had it under control." Vale lifted her brow. Jonathan shrugged. "She lunged at me. I saw the blade at the last second and parried it, then counterattacked with a riposte." Vale looked at Robbie. "What did he just say?" "I think he's talking fencing." "Yeah," Jonathan said. "Fencing. When you parry or block an attack, you've got a split second to launch a counterstrike, a riposte. Instead of pulling back, you attack quickly, before your opponent can recover and defend." "But you didn't have a sword," Robbie said. "Concept is tactical. Whether you have a weapon or not, it's reactions. Balance, muscle, memory. I reacted without thinking. I do that all the time without such good results. Maybe I should take up fencing." "Strategic analysis aside," Robbie said, "I'm real proud of you." He grabbed Jonathan's shoulders and looked into his eyes. "You okay?" Jonathan thought a moment. "I'm not sure. I don't know what I think. I mean, I killed someone." He stared off for a second as if it had just sunk in. "Sweetie, you killed someone who'd murdered about 24 people. You didn't have a choice. She was coming at you. And believe me, she was trying to kill you. This is a lot to grasp. I know. I've been there. We'll have you talk to someone. It'll help."
"Like a shrink?"
Vale drew a hand down his left cheek.
exactly like a shrink, and I don't want any pushback. I'm still your mother, even if you're technically an adult.
He shivered. Fine, I'll talk with someone.
Tomorrow. You'll talk with someone tomorrow.
Come on, it's friggin' cold out here.
Robbie clamped a hand around Jonathan's shoulders and led him toward the car.
I mean it, bud. I'm very proud of you.
Jonathan was silent for a few steps and then stopped.
I think I feel good about what I did. Is that wrong?
Wrong? Fail asked.
Well, there's a loaded question. From my son, no less.
No. You defended yourself. You did what needed to be done.
Jonathan absorbed that for a second.
Is this what it's like to be a cop?
Sometimes, Robbie said with a shrug. Yeah, getting the bad guy. You feel good you made things safer for people. That's what it's all about. Keeping order, upholding the law, saving lives.
Jonathan gazed off into the distance as he considered that.
Maybe I should think more seriously about a career in law enforcement.
Fail and Robbie shared a concerned look.
How about not? Fail said.
This isn't something you should decide after what just happened, Robbie said. You've got plenty of time to think it through. You're a criminal justice major. That's the right path if you want to carry a badge. That's all you need to think about now.
Jonathan nodded slowly.
Okay.
But Vale could tell by the look on his face that he had just decided what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. She knew that look. She knew it because she had seen it once before in the mirror.
This recording of The Darkness of Evil was presented by Dreamscape Media, LLC. Text copyright 2016 by Alan Jacobson. Sound recording copyright 2017, Dreamscape Media, LLC. This recording was produced by arrangement with Open Road Media. Thank you for listening.
Please check www.dreamscapeab.com for Dreamscape's latest releases.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Chapter 87. There she was, slumbering as usual. Snapping the wicket hatch shut, he drew the bolts and unlocked the door. He was still scrupulous about security, despite the thawing in their relations, and never hung around. He had paid the price for carelessness before.
Summer?
Shaking his head, he shut the door, locking it quietly behind him. Summer had never been a morning person. Sometimes it irritated him. Other times he found it entertaining. Today, he was in an indulgent mood.
We haven't got much time. But I can get you something nice for breakfast, if you like. I can do pancakes.
Pancakes had always been her favorite. Why shouldn't he spoil her now and again?
Summer.
He hurried over to her. He had reached her bedside and now leant over her.
Talk to me, Summer. Are you unwell?
He pulled back the sheet, but discovered only a rolled-up blanket underneath. Before he could process this, he heard footsteps coming up fast behind. He started to turn, but too late. The hard metal bit into the back of his head, and he collapsed heavily to the floor. He tried to raise himself, but was reeling with shock. Ruby didn't hesitate, bringing the long metal strut crashing down on his head again. It was heavy, and normally she would have struggled to lift it, but fired by adrenaline, she wheeled it freely now, bringing it down on the back of his head for a third time. This time, he hit the ground and didn't get up. Chapter 100.